With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
And a warm welcome to Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. I'm Joe Haddo, and wherever you're listening from, it's great to have you with us. Now, if you're new to Book Off, a very warm welcome, and we hope you enjoy this series as well as all of our backlist episodes. And if you're a regular listener, well, we know we love you, and that you're someone with really, really great taste. I mean, impeccable. Right then, on with our episode, and today I'm joined in the studio by two fabulous musicians and writers. My first guest is a songwriter and musician who spent the last 15 years uniquely chronicling the inner workings of his and everyone's human condition over six critically acclaimed albums. These include It's a Pleasure, Happy Soup, and most recently Night Chances, which I have not stopped listening to since 2020. Here to tell us about his new autobiography, Cheslong, it's Baxter Jury. Hello to you.
How do you do?
It's lovely to have you here. And my second guest is a musician, broadcaster and writer who formed Pulp, one of the most successful UK bands of the 90s, selling over 10 million albums worldwide. You can count them. He has also released five fabulous solo works. And between 2009 and 2017, he hosted the Sunday service on BBC Radio 6 Music, which is where we first met. Here to tell us about his first work of long-form prose, Good Pop, Bad Pop, it's Jarvis Cocker. Welcome to you.
Hello there.
It's lovely to have you both here. You know each other. I don't think I need to do introductions. You are mates.
Yes, how are you getting on?
I'm fine, thank you. Me and Jarvis are like a sort of modern-day Bloomsbury set.
Oh, yeah.
Meets the Kardashians.
Just peppered in there.
Yeah,
I can tell. Thank you both for being here, and it's going to be lovely to talk to you about your new books, about books in general, what you've been reading and enjoying, and of course we'll do the book off at the end as well. Baxter, Cheslong is your new autobiography. As I said, it's brilliant. I just ate it up. It's insane. In some places, sad. When did you decide you wanted to write it?
Well, I sort of had the idea. I know a guy called Ted Kessler, used to be the editor of Q magazines, very smart kind of acerbic journalist, and he encouraged me to write down some stories. And I did that 3 or 4 years ago, and he sort of got me motivated. And then I thought, this is very tough. But at the same time, I managed to wangle myself a book deal, but I still thought, well, that's some money and it looks pretty cool. That sounds quite cool if you've got a book deal, especially if you're residing, you know, if you're telling people on the Portobello Road. But I really, in the back of my mind, had no intention. I was fraudulently signed a book deal, basically. And then the pandemic happened. And I think my son was doing his A-levels and I just sort of hitched onto his schedule. And as a way of sort of a sanity rope. So I wrote it just to keep myself sane. And that's the only reason I wrote it.
For sanity. Yeah. I think it's a very good reason. But am I right in thinking you moved back into your childhood home when you were writing it or around the time you were writing it?
Yeah, it's quite cannibalistic.
Yeah.
Culturally cannibalistic. I was there prior to rewriting it, but I did end up in the space that it's all written about. And there's a sort of bleak cycle of existence at one point when you're there living with your son in a similar set of, well, not a similar set of circumstances, because we have changed and the attitudes have changed, thankfully. But it was a bit hard to revisit, but maybe it assisted being in the theatre of my dysfunctional Does that make sense? The theatre of my dysfunctional past.
Sounds good. Yeah.
Sounds excellent.
Could be a book title.
It is.
That's the next book, is it? I was going to say. Yeah. Mm, yeah. And Jarvis, Good Pop, Bad Pop is just about to come out. Mm. And I believe the idea for this was sparked by clearing out your loft. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's interesting to hear Baxter say that thing about being fraudulent, which I will report you to the police. You know that. But I had a similar feeling. I mean, my thing with the roots of my book were that I did a lyric book like about 10 years ago. Mm. And the woman who had bought the rights for that for Spain, she then left the publishing company, started a literary agency of her own and said, can I represent you? And I said, yes, you can, Monica. You can represent me because I liked her a lot. I got on with her well. But I said, I've got no intention of writing a book. I just got to tell you that at the very start of our relationship. But but she just wouldn't take that seriously and kind of got me a deal. A bit similarly, you know, said, got me a really good book deal. And then I just had to write a book, you know, just not to lose face, you know, and not to piss her off. But also, you know, I did always want to write a book. I guess everybody, lots of people think, yeah, well, I've got a book in me. You know, and it's like one of those things that kind of, it's in the distance, like, you know, when I'm a grown-up, mature person, I'm going to write a book, I'm going to start listening to classical music, you know, going to put me records in alphabetical order, you know, all these kind of things that you think you will do. But I never thought I'd get round to it.
Yeah.
But I did. I was kind of forced into it. The pandemic, similar to Baxter, had some effect there, made me think, well, if I'm not going to write it now, I'm never going to write it. May as well commit suicide. and it's weird that it ended up, like you say, it ended up being about the contents of a loft in a house that I used to live in. Huh. Because that was another thing that I'd been meaning to get round to forever. You know, I must tidy that up because I bet there's some interesting things in there. So I finally got round to it. And instead of doing the sensible thing of chucking all the stuff in a skip and then having lots of new storage space, I decided that I would look at every object I found up there, take a photograph of it, try and remember why it was there. And eventually they kind of assembled themselves into a kind of story.
Do you... Because I keep things and I keep stuff actually in my parents' loft most of
it. It's the best way. It's the best way.
But there's some stuff up there I go back to and I cannot throw it and I will not throw it. Was that the case for you? Were you coming back to things that you thought, oh, yeah, I remember a time when I thought maybe I don't need this or whatever and you just can't let it go?
It was a mixture. It was a mixture because there were things like that. There were things that I'd carted down from Sheffield when I first moved to London in like 1988 and I'd moved them from house to house, probably never looking at them, just in a box. Then there were the things that, like, say, if my mum was coming to London to visit and the house was a real shit tit, I would just gather stuff up and just throw it in the loft because, yeah, look, Mum, look, I'm living really tidily, I've got it together. So it was a mixture of, you know, these Proustian Madeleines from your childhood and also just shit, you know. Mm. I mean, the wrapper of a Madeleine.
What's a Proustian Madeleine?
A Proustian Madeleine, literary people have told me that that's like, you know, apparently in Proust's masterpiece, In Search of Lost Time, he eats a Madeleine and the taste of it and the smell of it takes him back to his childhood, you know, in a really vivid way, which is a thing. I do think the weird thing was, I'm going to shut up in a minute. I've not even had any coffee. But I did find that the bits of shit actually kind of triggered stronger memories and things that maybe I thought, you know, oh, I'll put that in the loft, like, that'll be good for me in my old age or whatever. Mm. It was the shit that really did it for me.
And sort of like, you know, Wrigley's wrapper as opposed to, you know, like an award that you won in the 90s or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I'm still thinking about Proust's.
Do you want one? I can order you one from the bakery next door if you want.
But they didn't decompose them. I'm sort of stuck on the wrong aspects of that. Anyway, carry on.
I was just trying to be literary. Somebody once said it to me, all right?
It's been regurgitated.
It was basically trying to show off. Sorry.
I've got to use it next in my TV meeting.
You've got a very important meeting to go to, so you can drop it in there and see what their reaction is.
Yeah, got it all wrong.
Have you got some of them?
Are you a sort of collector's the wrong word, hoarder's the wrong word? Have you got a load of sort of old shit, Baxter, that you keep?
Yeah, I kind of tend to keep shit, but I sort of destroy, smother, kill shit.
Okay.
So it doesn't naturally survive, and I don't have much storage. So I do try and...
What do you mean, smothering it?
I kind of break it and molest stuff. Is that weird to say? But and it naturally breaks, and it's no point in me keeping it. There's not many... There are kind of artifacts from my family who are all painters that I've kept sort of preserved. But beyond that, no, I just don't. I sub it all out. I get rid of it all. Constantly, like there's a constant sort of shedding of stuff constantly. So no, the opposite actually. So
when I was thinking about your book before we recorded this, I wondered if you referred back to a diary or anything for some of those earlier memories, or is it just, you know, from your head?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't try and be journalistic on purpose to not bore myself, really, because I just found that process so tiring. And also, I didn't want to do what... I think that would become another thing about, a journalistic thing about Dad, because essentially, Dad's quite a big, strong, impactful character in my life. And a lot of stuff that's occurred, I guess, stems from his way of life.
Mm.
And the more I started to investigate that chronologically or accurately, it sort of became a kind of article about him again. And I let the memory, my sense of fantasy sort of take over. And I didn't really, I wasn't untruthful, but I was just sort of a bit, just sort of let it, the memory be what it wanted to be when it needed to be.
That makes sense.
So I just made it into my story. I claimed it.
Yeah, which it is, you know, it is, and it is. It is your story, and it's about you and your childhood and your mother, and your dad's in there, obviously. But it's also you said, you didn't want it to be boring, and I don't know if you meant the process for you or, you know, the reader on the page, but it's absolutely it's shocking in some places. Do you think that readers like me will experience that, or have you heard that, you know, people who've read it have sort of found it a bit, oh right, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think I didn't have the skill range of a writer to sort of know how to philosophically soften it.
Mm.
You know what I mean? So I only could do raw data. And I think it's probably, I reduced it back a bit because, you know, lives are more boring, but they're also tougher. Maybe actually growing up was more tougher than that book suggests. And there were more extreme things and more boring. And there were nice passive moments where, you know, we ate porridge and things were normal. But I didn't know how to balance that in an excitable way.
Mm.
So this is the first time I never really went to school. So it's the first time I'd actually done any kind of extended form of writing that's not some pretentious lyric or thing that I throw off. It was quite easy, really.
Did you enjoy the process, though?
I did afterwards. I enjoyed the warmth and the smiles and the bravoing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I really did, and which Jarvis is about to experience.
Yeah.
I found that one of the most rewarding, just especially coming creeping out of lockdown. I found that going to these obscure little literary places and stuff, I really enjoyed it. I had a lot of fun.
And is Monica going to get a second book out of you now you've done this, Jarvis?
I don't know. We have to see how this one goes down, really.
But you enjoyed it?
I found we spoke about it, didn't we? Because when your book came out, there was like a kind of event at Rough Trade East, and we spoke about it and talking about what we thought about writing. It's not, to actually sit down and write isn't really pleasurable.
Yeah.
It's just because I tried loads of shortcuts at first. Like I hired a secretary, and I thought, I'll just sit in a corner, you know, looking out the window, and just talk, and she'll type it, and then, you know, like 5 days it'll be done, whatever. And then, so she took it away and she sent it back, you know, all typed up, and I just thought, fuck, that is so, you know, you realise that your vocabulary is really limited, you know, you're just repeating the same phrases over and over again, you think, fucking hell, just...
conversational.
You know,
writing.
You think, you know, it's a really humbling experience.
Yeah.
And then you realise that really putting words out through your fingers, you know, typing or writing, is a really different thing to talking.
Mm.
I mean, we've all experienced that in a way, in the way that people are so horrible to each other on emails and text. You know, it's like typing is like kind of evil in a way.
Controlled.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just different. And you can get better things. I mean, I think once I started actually typing the book, then it started to feel like it really was a book.
Yeah.
Maybe I've kept tiny bits from these ill-advised secretarial adventures. It was just like a fantasy, basically, that I was living out. Don't judge me. But, I mean, so I tried things like that, and then it was just a brutal fact of sit down, turn your computer on, make sure nobody's going to bother you and interrupt you, and just sit there and do it.
Yeah.
And, like, then read it after, cringe at some bits, delete them.
Yeah.
Some bit might make you laugh. Okay, expand on that a bit. And it just gradually, like a stalactite, starts to build itself.
Yeah. It's a sort of management of, you know, awareness of management, because really it's being able to separate yourself from what's good and bad. And I think you'd start to learn a little bit what's shitty and what's not. Don't you,
yeah. And I think, like you said, it's totally different to lyric writing. It's, you know, you think, oh, yeah, I'm a writer.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I've been writing for 40 years, whatever. But you haven't. You haven't been writing, like, book writing.
No. And is that also partly because with a book it's like, we need it by this point, whereas if
you...
No,
because I missed three deadlines, I think. Okay. How many deadlines did you miss?
It's just, it's dense. It's dense, and the lyric writing's just silly. It's like having the difference between having a cold and having a bowler.
Okay,
really. Right. Writing a book is like having a bowler, basically.
But is that, in your experience of lyric writing, is that because you're, I don't know, it's not as prescribed, you're not sitting down at a desk to write a song, an idea comes, you write a little idea and then it evolves?
Well, I'm pretty off the cuff, really. I'm a little bit raw like that. I don't think I really write much down, really. And maybe that's a skill and also a lazy habit of mine, not to be, I can sort of go, yeah, and there's a sort of valve that I can open.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, the consequence is sometimes inaudible, or like it doesn't mean much, you know, there's quite beat what I do. But I don't know how to do anything else lyric writing. But I actually find the process quite relaxing and easy. But this is an entirely different way of framing your thoughts. It's quite difficult to start organizing your thoughts, memories, and your need to be understood.
Yeah.
But that's quite an interesting thing. Did you find that you started to understand yourself a little bit better?
A bit, yeah. I mean, the thing that I found different was when you write a song, you know that there's going to be the music to kind of bolster it, and you can just kind of mumble, and people, as long as they can tell there's a human voice there somewhere, they're not, you know, they're just, often that's the thing, isn't it, with songs, it's the feel of it, really, and you know that something's going on, and maybe, you know, if you like the song, you'll take the trouble to try and decipher the lyrics. But the lyrics don't have to stand completely on their own, they're always interacting with the music.
You're contributing to an atmosphere, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah. But with the book, you have to do that, all of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, so it is so, yeah. I think you do get to know yourself, because, like, when I first started off, I was trying to put loads of jokes in. I had this kind of mental picture of someone who was bored and who I had to try really hard to kind of keep their attention. Oh, please keep reading my book, you know, please like me. And I just had to dial that down, because it's like having a needy partner, isn't it? It's like, fuck off, just leave me alone. It's like, let me read it and make my own mind up. Stop trying to ingratiate yourself. Yeah. So stuff like that, you do, you learn stuff about yourself.
It can't be raw anecdote. Suddenly you realise that you've got to frame something that makes sense overall, not for that moment where a lyric's very much concentrated on a sort of phrasing and a silly, in my case, just a silly concept.
Mm. And telling stories orally down the pub, remember them, you know, is different to actually taking that story that might have got quite a nice reaction, say, if we told it here, then writing that down on the page, and you think, no, that's not, it's just not going to fly, or it just doesn't, it lands there's, quite dead.
There was no lager involved.
Yeah, there's no tone.
No tone.
I mean, finding a tone or a voice within your writing that's sort of loud and quiet and emotional is very difficult, I find.
Yeah,
and without also, being pretentious.
And like you were saying, like often with songs, you kind of get straight in with a punchline. You want someone to keep their interest. I think there's a bit of that in writing, but then if you can't write like that because it's wearying. You know, if you're always giving people punchlines, well, you're just going to knock them out after a while. You know, just like it puts you off. So you have to kind of make it so there's some bits where it just trickles for a while.
Yeah.
And then ambience. Something will happen, you know. And getting your head around that of things having to take place over this extended period of time is...
Yeah,
it's a completely different way of writing.
Mm. Yeah, it's padding. A lot of writing is padding.
Yeah,
and spelling.
Yeah,
but really basic things were the things that did mean like, and just like I kept putting that. I kept using the word that, and I was thinking, well, you don't need that. So I had to cut loads and loads of that out, and then the order of words, really basic like building blocks of constructing a sentence. Because, and the thing that I don't know if you. The thing that unlocked it for me quite a lot was when I'd kind of got it to a certain stage, then we started doing the editing, and because it was COVID, I had to do it by Zoom. So it was really complicated and trying to share stuff on the screen.
Yeah,
and I just said, you know what, I'll just read it. We'll do a page at a time, and we'll just talk about what it was like. And that really was the best thing I ever did, because when you read something, then... You know, you can get halfway through a paragraph and just think, this is bullshit. You know, I don't even believe that.
Yeah.
Or the bits you think, oh, yeah, this is good. And that really helped a lot in the kind of making it kind of seem to have a voice in some way.
And a lot of authors I know do read their work out loud before they submit it for the second edits or something. And they always say, you know, in doing that, it adds something and you can tell almost straight away if it's working or
what's flowing. I mean, I found that I just didn't. I wasn't interested in the grammar. I was so unable to, you know, I couldn't get that together.
Yeah.
And I had a very helpful panel of people that I just sort of. I mean, one half of my management is very literary, and then that would go. So I was very helped. So I just didn't bother in the end, and I haven't learned anything. I haven't advanced in any way.
I bet you have.
A little
you
bit.
Might not realise.
I'm quite. It's like it's written on a prison wall. Mike, it's quite kind of jagged, and so they receive quite a feral manuscript. You know, it's quite a.
Yeah, but that's a good point you make there, though, because that's another thing that I've not been used to is somebody else helping with it and being involved in it. Like I had a similar thing. Well, a really fundamental thing actually, because when the book started, it had a different title. This book is a song, and. The thing about the loft was just like one small part of it.
Mm.
And then this woman called Anna Fletcher at Cape just said, that's the best bit, get rid of the rest and just make it all about that. Mm. And you know, and it took me like a weekend to think, what the fuck? How are you to tell me about my writing? And then suddenly I just thought, you know what? She's absolutely right.
Yeah.
And I did. So I kind of had to start again then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it made it
much
better.
Oh, these publishing people, they know what they're saying.
They
but
do,
it's fine.
They
you
do.
Don't I imagine you don't really, you know, it's not like you send a song off to someone and go, just check this for me. You think it would be, you know, is this lyric going to work for you? It's not the same, is it?
Yeah.
Well, I loved both of these books. I really did. I think they're absolutely fab, and I do hope you're going to write more. And before we do the book off, where each of you is going to pitch as a book that you love, that you think we should all read, I always like to ask my guests what they've been reading recently or anything they've picked up that they think, you know, should have a mention, whether that be to champion an author, new or old.
Yeah.
Have you found some time to read recently, Baxter?
Have
you got any recommendations?
My brain is a fickle instrument, depends on what's going on, and then I have a period. I've just come back, as I tell everybody, from Costa Rica, where I became quite obsessed by surfing, which you know, I've been thinking and talking about that mostly, but I really like this book called Warlight, which is by Michael
Ondaatje.
I never can say his surname.
And he wrote The English Patient.
He wrote The English Patient, but it's all set where I live as well. And there's a sort of parallel to my book where these kind of undefinably bohemian kids get looked after by a bloke called the Moth. Have you read this book?
And
they go up and down Putney smuggling greyhounds in the 1950s. And I was just there, and it references places that I live opposite.
Yeah.
And, you know, because I'm a sort of river Cockney, a river Mockney. And I totally relate to him. The story is essentially flawed, but the first half of it is just tremendous.
Mm.
And I totally relate to it. And his writing is probably the best. He's up there.
Stunning, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so even with the story flawed, the first half of it is the best story I've ever written. I've written. That was a bit weird, wasn't it?
Yeah. Weird. I called Claim up Michael
it.
And
Claim
I said,
it.
Michael, the best story I've read,
yeah.
not written. And the second half isn't just sort of suffers from it being so good.
Yeah. You know,
it's almost Dickens. It's almost as good as anything. And this is another little book someone gave me the other day called A Way of Life. A Way of Life Like Any Other by a bloke called Darcy O'Brien. And this it's a fictional biography, really. And it's based on the way he was brought up in Hollywood, and his dad was a in John Wayne films, he was a cowboy.
Oh wow, really?
And his dad really was a cowboy, but he's sort of written a fictional version of growing up in Hollywood. And it also everything narcissistically leads back to me, because I think someone gave me this because they must both of these books, because they must have had
right.
Yeah.
So everything's about me.
That sounds really
just,
good. Though,
as I said, as I just realised, these books are about me. I put them away. Actually,
that's a nice realisation then.
Yeah, but I really love those two.
No, but everybody, when you read, you do look for that though, don't you? You look for something that chimes with you.
Identify.
That's what you're kind of after.
Yeah.
So you just all come back to yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about you? What have you been reading recently?
I've been I was a bit slow getting into Karl Ove Nausgaard.
Ooh.
I'm now on the third one, the one Boyhood Island.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of was I think I told you about it,
I
didn't
started
I?
It, yeah. I mean, whoa.
It's tough.
The start's good though, don't
yeah,
you think?
I mean,
the
yeah,
first...
I just find it quite yeah. I mean, I'm a sensitive.
Yeah, but I thought, I don't know, I was a bit, it's like, I read the first kind of 20 pages, I thought, wow, this is amazing, you know. Then he starts describing deciduous trees.
Yeah.
And then I realised there wasn't going to be like an end of a chapter. It's just like one fucking long paragraph for 600 pages.
Yeah.
So I thought, fucking hell, this is going to be a bit of a thing. But I've gone with it, and it becomes a bit hypnotic. You know, you kind of, you've got these bits where he'll describe frying some salmon for like 3 pages. You're thinking, it's not even a recipe. It's just like a normal thing. I'm just going, okay, I know what a fucking salmon is. I know what a frying pan is. I know what oil is. Fucking get on with the book now. And you know, you're ready to throw it away. And then there'll be like a paragraph where there's this amazing insight of something. So, and somehow you have to have that padding in a way for these bits to make sense. I don't know. So I'm enjoying kind of, well, enjoying might not be the right word, but I respect it.
Mm.
You know, it's like, it's recognisable. It's about real life. I mean, it's just like, you know, if he was writing about this, our conversation, he could probably make it into a whole book. You know, we've just been talking for 45 minutes, but he'd find a way of making it into a three-volume.
Is it what you call auto-fiction? Or what? Is it like a thing that's sort of based, there's a thread of realness in it?
Yeah. I think you're right, yeah. I think that's what they call it in France, isn't it? They've kind of had that tradition for a bit longer. But anyway, there's him. And then... have you read this woman, Lucia Berlin? She's no longer alive.
No, I haven't, but you're the second person to talk about Lucia Berlin very recently.
I've not started this one yet. This is Evening in Paradise, but the one that someone gave me first was called A Manual for Cleaning Women.
That's right.
And they're quite autobiographical stories. But I think you would like it, actually. I couldn't bring the other book because Kim's reading it now. That's my partner, you know, I couldn't nick her. But,
no, fair enough.
they're great. I mean, she's just had quite a crazy life. Was an alcoholic for a long time, bringing the kids up, just living in quite strange circumstances.
Where?
in America.
Oh, okay.
She lived in South America for a while and had quite a fancy life, and then lived on the margins. I don't know, just good writing. You know, sometimes you get writing that kind of brings you back to life. In a way, you know, somebody describes life in such a vivid way.
Yeah.
It really makes you feel it. Like, you can feel like the blood seems to run through your veins a bit faster. And she's like that. So I think she's really good. And then that's another woman, right, that someone recommended during lockdown, Lydia Davis. I kind of like short stories. Do you like short stories?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
Because her stuff, Lucia Berlin is mainly short stories, and these Lydia Davis ones are, I mean, sometimes like really short, half a page.
Oh, right.
You know? Yeah, I mean, super short. But there's one called Break It Down, this one. That's an amazing story. Like, it's like this guy, I'm not going to, no, but I just, but there's one called Break It Down anyway, which I would say, if you want an entry point to her writing, Break It Down by Lydia Davis. And with Lucia Berlin, there's a story called Tom Perdu, which brings us back to the Proustian Madeleine. Maybe that's where I got the idea from.
Yeah.
Where she's working in a hospital and she sees this guy, and he's got the same eyes as this guy she used to hang out with when she was young. And suddenly she goes into this crazy remembrance of the shit that they got up to when they were kids. And it's really good.
Wow.
Yeah, very good.
Fantastic. I love a short story before bed, I have to say. That's, you know, you sometimes don't need the full chapter or to get back into a book or anything, but a little short story just to send me off.
Can I just add to the short story thing?
They're of course.
Really short, actually. Look how big they are. Have you ever read these? The sort of offcuts of this guy, Cormac McCarthy, wrote The Road all the Coen brothers thing, you know.
I've not read those.
These guys are all just things set on the Mexican-American border. And one's about a wolf going back to try and find his, where he wants to die. And it's just about him going from New Mexico into Mexico. That is excellent, actually. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for all those recommendations.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And it's time for another, because it's time for the Book Off, where each of you is going to get 3 minutes uninterrupted, if you want to use it, to tell us about a book you love and you think we should all read. The usual rules are that whoever's travelled the furthest gets to choose whether they go first or second. So I suppose that is dependent on which side of London. If indeed you've both come from
London. Both come from West London, but that's probably you, Baxter, because you've come from Hammersmith and I've come from Shepherd's Bush Market.
Right, so Baxter's just
so I'm
clinched
first,
it.
Am I?
Well, no, you get to decide.
Oh, I'll just go, because mine's confusing. I don't know if this is a competition. This is not like a thing, is it? Because I've chosen is quite complicated.
It's a cooperation.
Exactly. It's a nice thing.
It's a collab.
Because I tried to write down... I brought my big computer just because I tried to write down... How much I understand about this book, and I don't really understand it, but I really enjoy it. But okay. I just kind of put this down.
You put that there, yeah.
I put my Madeleine over there.
And Jarvis, you get to choose which instrument you get rung out at the 3 minutes. So would you like the school bell, or do you want the bicycle horn?
Yeah, the horn, please.
The horn for you. So that's the bell for you, Baxter. If you indeed are talking over the 3 minute mark, you don't have to use it all.
Yeah, I thought I was already. Can I not stop?
And just,
Jesus, I'm a bit.
Yeah, let me move that, then you can.
I'm having a tender moment.
And just before we start the timer, tell us the name of the book that you're talking about.
Hard Boiled Wonderland and the End of the World.
Fantastic. Over to you then.
Murakami, whatever his name is. I've not read lots of them. I've read a couple, and I guess this is sort of traditional for him to be very deadpan and totally bonkers, and expect you to accept his version of how mad it all is. And I like that because he doesn't fuck around. You know what I mean? And this ultimately does not fuck around, and I found it punishing because my sense of attention is really challenged with this book. And so for the first 100 pages you're restructuring the way you think, and he reinvents a world very close to a world that exists. Considering this book is written in the mid 80s, just all its sort of parlance, the words he uses, the concepts are incredibly advanced, I think. But isn't the reason why I love this, and I don't know if I did love it, but I just found it very impactful or powerful. And I'm not getting to the point. The point is, it's a book set, I guess, in Tokyo, and it's about and the narrator of the book is what you call a calutech, and whose job is to process encrypted human data, right? So he's like some dude that has a job that you accept within the context of the story, and he gets hired by a kind of mysterious scientist that lives in an underground sewer underneath. I'm actually quite lost already. But I'm going to get to the point. The point is that he's hired by this scientist who's experimenting with how you stop sound. And he encrypts data by delving into his subconscious. There's a process, and when each time that he's encrypting data, he goes back into his subconscious, and he goes to this town called the End of the World. Modern day Tokyo is known as the Hard Boiled Wonderland, and that's which is never really referenced in the book, but you know because of the title. And this weird subconscious town is called the End of the World. And the End of the World, he's a dream reader, and he tries to, I mean, I don't really understand this book at all. I mean, I'm just trying to explain that it's so dense and complex, yeah, and so beautifully written, and it drip feeds you this world that by sort of 200 pages you're so immersed in, and you're so thrown between the two worlds. By the time it finishes, you're sort of left broken and happy and sad.
Very good.
Really? I mean, I don't know if I explained that very well.
I'm intrigued, yeah. I'll be honest with you.
Yeah.
There was some lovely stuff in
there. Work out whether I'm emotionally stable enough to put myself through that.
We'll come back and talk about it in a moment, Baxter, okay, if I may, but you can have a little breather now, because I'm putting 3 minutes back on the clock for you, Jarvis. Just before we start, what book are you putting forward?
I'm putting forward George Sanders' A Swim in a Pond in the Rain.
Fantastic. All right, 3 minutes on the clock then, over to you.
Well, the kind of subtitle of the book is In Which Four Russians Give a Masterclass on Writing, Reading and Life. And I suppose that's what I found interesting about this, is that you're getting good value, because George Sanders is an author. He's been writing for ages, but I only became aware of him, I don't know, a year ago. Maybe, you know, it's funny how you can have that, can't you? You know, like somebody's been doing something, you think, I'm a cultural person, I'm plugged in, I know what's going on. And obviously I don't, because I was never aware of this guy's writing. He writes fiction. He's also he also teaches at some college. I can't remember the name of the college. He teaches at some college in America. And so what you're getting with this book is you're getting an introduction to him, of what he likes in writing. He selected stories by... I'm allowed to look at which ones, aren't I? So I know that Chekhov's in there. Chekhov, Turgenev, Tolstoy, Gogol. There we go. The big hitters. Obviously, maybe reading Russian literature at the moment might not be as popular as it has been recently, but we shouldn't let that put us off. So, yeah, I mean, part of the reason... I had read another book by George Sanders called Lincoln in the Bardo that I really enjoyed. But part of it was, you know, again, it's like what we were talking about earlier, things that you feel that you should get round to. And reading Russian literature is one thing that you think, yeah, I feel I should get round to it, but never seems that appealing. It's just like, maybe I could watch a rerun of Dynasty instead, you know, something a bit lighter. Because you know that, you know, the Russians, I think rightfully, have got that kind of reputation that they're not fucking around. It's just like, okay, you're a human being. I'm going to tell you exactly what human life's like. I'm going to take it down to the core. And there's going to be no way to wriggle your way out of it. Just look at yourself, you know, and not everybody's used to that. But what I was surprised by was at least the stories that he selected for this collection don't send you off into a dark midnight of the soul. They are based in the life, you know, it's Russia, so it's not some of the details of the life you don't completely recognize, but the way that people act you recognize. So you get that, the pleasure of reading those stories. Then you get him, I guess, using some of the stuff that he uses in his classes when he's teaching people to write, you know, how he takes those stories apart and then just adds in bits. The thing I liked about it was it wasn't like a high-blown literary thing. He brings in just like little stories from his own life, you know, normal things, and makes it very accessible.
Very good. Oh, fabulous. Thank you both for those. What a selection. I'll come back and talk about George in a moment, Jarvis, if I may. Just to come back to you, Baxter, and this fabulously, obviously bonkers book that you did tell us about a bit.
I don't think I read it, actually. I had some notes. Honestly, and I got nervous on the notes.
No, I loved it, because what you actually, you know, despite trying to tell us the plot, maybe, which is the hardest part, you said, you know, this, it drip feeds this world. It's, it completely immerses you. It's beautifully written. And I know that about Murakami, who is a fabulous writer. I don't know this book, but I am honestly so intrigued, thanks to your pitch there, to try and...
I've read a few of the others and I was a bit like, yeah, it's a bit predictable cliche. And I know, you know, students are into it and angular people. And I thought, fuck off.
Like me.
Yeah, fuck off. And then all that. And then I thought, when I was reading this, I was, fuck off. It was just so... And then I was, bing. And then I thought, this is... he's so smart.
You were in.
I mean, he's so... And he swims 15 miles a day and runs backwards 20.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean...
And he's smart.
He's smart. Yeah. And
I'd like to kiss his neck.
See if that opportunity arises. And with your book, Jarvis, I know of George Saunders from the Booker Prize. He's got a great collection of short stories called The 10th of December, which you should absolutely check out if you like him and if you like short stories. It's fabulous. This book I didn't know, but I mean, I definitely need to get round to more Russian literature. You're right. You're actually right. And how many times do people go, oh, I must read War and Peace. I will get to it. You read it?
Yeah.
Oh, well sort done. Well done.
I know the story.
Yeah, I watched the film or the TV adaptation. Yeah. But I think, yeah, he's a wonderful writer. He's a wonderful human and I imagine a great teacher. And so to get that sort of, as you put it, good value, where you get these recommendations, but you also get his sort of take on it, sounds fab as well. So I thought both of these were absolutely brilliant. But I have to take one home, you see. That's the whole point. I'm going to take George Saunders. think I'm going to take George, just for the fact that I am underread in Russian literature. However, this Murakami, which I do not know, I'm going to check out. So thank you.
You're not allowed to read that now.
I'm not.
I'm going to another book podcast now. Where they're more appreciative of my talents. And I've got a TV meeting. Have you got a TV meeting?
No, I haven't got a TV meeting. I haven't got anything.
So.
No. I think that's why I had to give it to Jarvis. He hadn't got a TV meeting either. So, you know.
Do you want to come to my
Good Pop, Bad Pop by Jarvis Cocker is out now. It's published by Vintage, and Chaise Longue by Baxter Jury is also out now. It's published by Corsair. What an absolute pleasure to spend this time with you both. Thank you for your time, your recommendations, and it's lovely to see you both.
Brilliant. Cheers.
Thank you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.